fed up with the healthcare system, tired of the corporate control? Maybe the patient revolution is what you need to learn about.
Figuring out what needs to be done, where they are, to move away from the processing of people, focus just simply on access and efficiency and throughput, and instead thinking about how do we support clinicians, whether these are therapists, pharmacists, nurses, physicians, in noticing what is going on, what is the problematic situation of this person.
Our guest today is Dr. Victor Montori. He's in the top 1% of the most frequently cited health services researchers in the world for his work on shared decision making and minimally disruptive care. And he's leading the patient revolution.
Our movement seeks to turn away from the industrialization of healthcare, where the processing of people is what replaces caring.
This is Conversations on Healthcare.
Dr. Montori, welcome to Conversations on Healthcare.
Thank you for having me.
You know, you're a practicing endocrinologist at the Mayo Clinic and author of the book, Why the Revolt, Why We Revolt, and you head up the patient revolution. I will say revolution is a strong word, but I wonder if you could describe your views for our listeners.
Yeah, and we don't need that word as a branding or a cute thing. I think we have to remember that the word revolution it's turn. It implies turning. And our movement seeks to turn away from the industrialization of healthcare, where the processing of people what replaces caring, which is what people expect when they come into healthcare. And when you turn away from industrialized healthcare, we hope that what we turn away to is not further, artificial forms of care, but rather careful and kind care for all. And so we have a global movement that is trying to achieve that worldwide.
Well, I think you catch people right there when you say kind healthcare. I think everybody seeks that. You work as a group to investigate and disseminate the evidence that, quote, helps illuminate the negative impact of industrialization, as you just described. But you do this through what you term the greenhouse. Tell us about the greenhouse.
Yeah, so our movement, the Patient Revolution, has three major programs. One is the community of care activists acting all over the world. These are care Patient Revolution fellows who are acting locally, figuring out what needs to be done, where they are, to move away from the processing of people, focus just simply on access and efficiency and throughput, and instead thinking about how do we support clinicians, whether these are therapists, pharmacists, nurses, physicians, in noticing what is going on, what is the problematic situation of this person, and then working with that person with both competence and compassion in responding well to what is going on in ways that really advance the patient's situation forward. So that community of care activists is what we support. And we support them in two ways. One is through a school that offers courses on what do we mean really by careful and kind care, and how might we bring about change at scale in healthcare systems worldwide. And greenhouse, which is what you asked me about, which is the place where we try to create novel solutions, both in terms of understanding, thinking about things, and thinking about how to frame them and name them. Sometimes that's the first step in creating change. And then also coming up with tools and policies that might just work in bringing about careful and kind care for everyone. And with those two supports, we think we can help our community develop the skills and courage to make that change.
Margaret, Dr. Montori just said it was beyond the United States, seemed to be a global movement. Maybe you could tell us a little more about the work that you're doing with fellows around the world, and what are the goals for the fellowship program that sounds like it's international in scope?
Correct. And it's interesting. I'm originally from Peru, and I've done all my career in the United States, all my clinical career in the United States. And when I, with my colleagues, set out to do this, initially we thought that the scope of the change that was necessary was mostly, you know, within the United States. But we quickly recognized that around the world, there are many ways in which healthcare systems end up not providing the necessary conditions for people to either give care or receive care. In some countries, it is because of policies of austerity, and those publicly funded systems, you know, have not invested enough in healthcare. And as a result, those resources at the time patients and clinicians come together, they're just not there. And so people have to be seen very quickly without proper attention to what's going on and without the technologies and the thoughtfulness of actually resolving their problems. In other places, like my home country, it is a combination of poverty and mismanaged resources and incompetence and corruption that actually brings that about, if not just simply greed in the pursuit of profits. In the United States, we have a similar combination of all three factors, depending on the different healthcare systems that we talk about. So in all those cases, the final common pathway of all these problems is not enough time, not enough resources to care. And so the movement has to necessarily be global. Our fellows are folks that come from all walks of life. There are patients, there are caregivers, there are designers, engineers, lawyers, healthcare professionals, administrators that remember why they either sought care and didn't get it, or why they went into professions of healthcare to care and then find themselves unable to do so. That voltage between what should happen and what does happen gives them energy to bring about change.
But if you looked at what should happen, what does happen, what's the business model behind it? Because in some ways you're opposed to what's currently happening in the financing structure. What does this model look like? Is it a fee for service world? Is it how does it work?
Yeah, a lot of discussions about healthcare focus on, you know, what is the business model? But it's interesting that I think initially the core question is, what is this for? Healthcare is an investment that we make in each other to advance our flourishing, to prevent disease from representing a limit to our ability to realize our hopes and dreams. And as an investment, just like education, the question is really not what is the business model so we can get value for money. It is first and foremost, how do we make sure that that mission gets realized? And so I think that debate has been warped by an effort to make sure that when you create a business model for healthcare, not only is there enough money to pay for everybody that wants to be paid, but there's also opportunity for profit making, both by the pharmaceutical industry, insurance providers, and device manufacturers and other folks. I think the discussion first is, what do we want to really offer each other when we invest in healthcare? Then we might actually uncover different and innovative models that not only enable that investment to realize its purpose, but also make it sustainable and capable of innovation. That is an open question, and that's, I think, something that is open also for revolution.
So, Dr. Montori, as a nurse by profession, I certainly was schooled deeply in the science of caring and some of the strategies that nursing uses to bring that into daily practice. But I think the thing we all learn along the way is you've got to have structure and supports that make it possible for you to do what you set out to do. And I think that's true in medicine and nursing and any other of the health professions. Maybe share an example with us, if you can, with your students and the others that work with you in this area. How have you been able, do you have some examples, to design this care environment differently or the strategies? I think we can say with a pretty high degree of confidence, people come into the health professions wanting to help, wanting to care, and they bump up against a lot of obstacles, time, of course, being one of the key ones. But tell us about some of the things that you have found successful in your work over these last many years.
Yeah, to your last point, to start there, I think the current healthcare system, no matter where you look, is unsustainable financially, environmentally, but profoundly humanly unsustainable. Clinicians, as you point out, show up to care, and about 40% of them are thinking about quitting the profession or quitting clinical care. 40% of patients who live with multiple chronic conditions are overwhelmed by the tasks that healthcare transfers to them. So we really are looking at a system that is supposed to promote human flourishing, and yet is humanly unsustainable. What might be potential ways forward? It's amazing because you don't have to invent many of them. You just have to observe carefully where people, like you said, motivated by the right thing, have been able to do this in ways, and just make sure that you share that with folks that might not see that or know that, and then they can do it. For instance, simple things. Where I work, the building in which I work was designed in the 1950s. And back then, somebody decided to put very thick walls separating the clinical offices from the hallway, and put cork floors on the hallway. And you think, you know, that's not the most cost-efficient way of building at the time. No, it was not. But somebody made that choice because they decided that what happened in those rooms was sacred and had to be the content had to be kept private in those offices. And the conversations that we wanted to happen, because that suggests collaboration in those hallways, should not be let to interrupt what is going on in those offices. So it's interesting that architecturally, we've made some decisions about creating the conditions for care that you can observe in different offices. But if you go to some modern ones, you will see that the choice has been made related to cost, you know, thin walls, thin doors, and noisy hallways. The content of the interaction, how patients and clinicians come together, we've introduced electronic health record systems that actually sit often between the patient and the clinician, demanding attention, where the clinician has to spend time documenting care, often at the expense of caring. And so there are models now to actually try to set aside the computer system to actually focus on the conversation.
You know, I do want to pull the thread back on the model here, because we come from the community health center world where healthcare is a right, not a privilege, serving a low income population. We have to think about how do we sustain that and what's the practical reality so this vision, which you have around a patient revolution, can spread. And so it's not a bad thing as much as if we don't do that, then we're doing a disservice to the population that we serve. So thinking about the population you serve, really trying to move all the noise out about business and the like, how do you see this sustaining itself and growing? Because I assume that's what you want to have happen.
Yeah. Oftentimes, we think that the best conditions for care can be found in places that cater to those more privileged. But some of the best examples of careful and kind care are from safety net hospitals, community health centers, refugee care. I was once at a conference where a leader for the refugee clinic in Denmark was giving a talk, and he was describing a patient situation and of a woman who had gone all to Denmark all the way from Syria with, you know, tremendous exposure to harm and trauma. And by the time she came into the consultation, she was experiencing some unclear symptoms. And she said, well, the clinician that was giving the talk said that he just sat down and was talking to her, listening to her and trying to understand her situation. And about an hour into their conversation, he was able to figure out what this woman really needed. And so I raised my hand and said, like, wait a minute, you're running a refugee clinic that is outside of the Danish healthcare system, that is massively underfunded, incredible demand for care, and you gave this woman 1 hour to figure out what's wrong? And he was taken aback. And for him, it was pretty obvious that he had not spent that hour. If he had responded quickly with a test or a treatment, that woman would have actually ended up in the back of the queue again. And this would not have resolved his problem of demand. And so it's very interesting to me that those people who really are involved in this know that there's something beyond simply attending to the queue and just making sure there's enough access and throughput. But there's actually needs to be care. And if you cannot care, then your system is just giving the illusion of access to care without care itself.
You know, it's interesting. I think, Mark, you would agree with me that some of the most attractive positions within our organization are those that take our providers to where the patients with some of the most complex challenges are: mobile health units, homeless shelters, migrant farms, and what they have in common, of course, is an intensity of need, but also less of the focus on the interval of time that you have to see the patient. So the good news is those patients really do get an intensity of care.
And their programs that and where programs the patients is, are yeah. versus where we are.
Yeah, right? Exactly. But I think it's one of the interesting sort of realities of our life right now in healthcare, certainly in primary care, that the thing that may bring us back to more face-to-face time without the barrier of the electronic health record in front of us and typing away during visits is AI, right? A technology intervention that will scribe our notes, code our procedures and diagnosis and billing, and maybe give back to people a little more of that very human intensity of focus. And I'm wondering if that's been your experience in your health system as you've probably integrated electronic scribing and coding and so forth. Is there a, dare I say, a contribution to more joy in practice through having more of that opportunity to be in connection with patients?
Yeah, I think there's a duality there, right? On the one hand, there's this issue of proximity, closeness, connection that you describe as essential here, which there's an enormous pressure right now to digitize. And so with the idea that we can reach more people at lower cost at all times if we just do digital first. And yet you've highlighted, I think correctly, that a lot of the care that is really necessary is thrives in environments in which we get to proximity. At the same time, there is the technology that can actually get some of the stuff out of some of the stuff that is unnecessary for care out of the way, so one could focus and be present and be able to respond well. We've actually implemented where I work an AI system that does what you described, you know, produces a note without us having to take notes and so forth. And I've used it myself quite extensively and noticed a couple of things. First, that I can be more attentive to the conversation with the patient without focusing so much on the documentation, even if it was my practice not necessarily to document directly on the computer, but actually take notes by hand. But even that, it becomes unnecessary if this system is capturing most of the information. The second part of that, which is interesting, is that it produces a note, but it's a note that doesn't necessarily reflect not the content, but the flavor of the conversation I just had. And so compared to the notes that I would write myself from scratch to these ones that are produced for my editing, which I ended up doing quite a bit of editing, these notes have all the information, but they don't have any of the flavor.
The story.
The humanity of the interaction. And my metaphor is, it's almost like fluorescent lighting where you actually want incandescent light, you know, and where you want warmth and you want shadow and you want nuance and you want volume. It gives you flat truth. And I think there's an opportunity, which is why I spend the time in editing, to make sure that that note reflects our conversation, particularly because all our notes are available to our patients. And I don't want my patients to think that what they experience in the one-to-one interaction, which I hope is warmth and connection, that it doesn't it was fake, and what's true is what is reflected on the note.
You know, you just said a phrase that I want to pull the thread on: thrive in an environment. So let's talk a little bit about your environment. You're in the Mayo Clinic, which is the largest integrated not-for-profit medical group in the world. So I have to ask the question about thriving. What's the reaction from Mayo and your peers to your call for a revolution and this model?
Yeah, it's always strange, right? Because we're supposed to be, I think, never satisfied in trying to pursue the patient's best interest. That's what drives our organization. At the same time, Mayo is not immune to the same influences and environments that other organizations are being affected by, which are forcing the change in healthcare, some of it for good, some of it perhaps in undesirable directions. So I think every organization like Mayo has its own strategies to adapt and do better in different environments, including its own innovation and process improvement approaches. Revolution is usually not in the script, right? It's not in the list of things that, it's not in the capabilities of an organization. In fact, organizations try not to upset themselves too much because they have particularly places like Mayo, have an organization that actually makes it very effective as a way of responding to people's challenges. And yet, you know, you look at the direction of the healthcare system and you look at the direction of patient need and you think, you know, there seems to be a mismatch here in which people are being processed instead of receiving care, in which caregivers are showing up and yet they're finding themselves facing moral injury and quitting what is actually one of the most incredible ways of making a living and being a human. So there's something fundamentally wrong. And I think the call for revolution is a call to pay attention to the fundamentals and make sure that in the face of all these potential technological developments, that we don't lose track that the fundamental thing is that to care is human and that we shouldn't bypass the humans when it comes to offering and receiving care.
Well, we live in interesting times. That's sort of become, you know, almost my standard what I say to myself in the morning when I wake up. Part of these interesting times, of course, is what's going on nationally. We've been talking about some of the special populations we all care for, the desire to do good, to care, to bring science and caring together. But we've just seen the president has signed the one big beautiful bill, and a clear consequence would seem to be that people we may have traditionally cared for will find themselves without access to care, that there will be limitations. We're seeing some of the trauma of individuals and families who face deportation, probably one of the greatest traumas that can happen. I'm curious, in your organization, and I think most of us, without knowing Mayo directly, the reputation speaks for itself as an organization with principles and a set of values. How are you handling anticipating these changes or some of the changes that are already here as an organization, as a medical staff, nursing staff, ethicists, the folks that staff the Mayo Clinic, as you think about some of the big challenges ahead?
Yeah, you have to ask that question to the organizational leaders in terms of their ability to respond. I can tell you that all of us sort of at the ground level in responding to our needs for our patients, we have to pay attention to the fact that as the world becomes increasingly develops these policies or lives through these policies that are increasingly cruel, that individuals are actually suffering. And we know that the suffering, the kind of structural suffering that people are experiencing is the kind of suffering that drives chronic disease, both in terms of mental and physical health deteriorations, requiring more and more clinical care. And it will be a mistake, and I think all of my colleagues and I recognize it, to respond to that exclusively through biomedical means. And I think the current circumstance requires us to not only pay attention to the patient in front of us, but actually pay attention to the societies and communities in which we work and figure out and think through and act to actually bring about better conditions, more just conditions in which people can actually thrive. Healthcare, again, is a way of reducing one of the barriers for people's realization or flourishing, which is the barrier introduced by disease and, in fact, sometimes by treatment. Some of these policies that are fundamentally cruel actually introduce further barriers for the realization of the opportunities and capabilities that some folks have. And it will be limited if our scope was limited to what we can do in the office. And so as part of our work, I think we all recognize that we must all be advocating constantly, openly, and loudly for a more just world in which the policies that we institute fundamentally advance our ability to care for and about each other. That true freedom comes from the ability to do what we want to do, to live in the ways we want to live, knowing that if all falls apart, we will receive the care of all around us. I don't think that we are at that point or not anywhere close. And so as a result of that, the work towards freedom is incomplete.
You know, Margaret, you were talking about changes in healthcare, and certainly, Doctor, you're an endocrinologist working on some of the more important issues, and you're focused in Mayo Clinic on caring for patients with diabetes. And speaking of change, it looks like that world of diabetes is going under tremendous treatment change with these new GLP-1 drugs. I'm just wondering what your view is on that particular medication and that particular intervention.
It's one more tool in our toolbox. It's one more way in which we can help people with diabetes live longer lives, live lives with fewer limitations. Traditionally, diabetes treatments have lowered blood sugar. Think of that. I'm talking about patients with type 2 diabetes. Patients with type 1 diabetes, of course, depend on insulin for their to live nowadays full lives with almost no limitations, but a lot of work. But patients with type 2 diabetes have historically, their treatment has focused historically on lowering blood sugars, which is the same as if you were to say that the way to fight off infection is to focus on fever instead of fighting off the bug that caused the infection. Right. And so in diabetes, we've had a hard time figuring out what's the bug. And so we've managed to always fight against blood sugar elevations and bringing down blood sugar. So some of the new drugs, among which is this GLP-1 receptor agonist that you mentioned, are now seem to be driving interventions into somewhere closer to what would be the equivalent of that infection instead of focusing on the symptom, the fever. And as a result, we're seeing patients not only losing weight, but also reducing the risk of developing complications of diabetes focused on the heart, the liver, and the kidney, or even sleep. And all of these are good news for our patients with diabetes. Of course, the companies that produce these drugs have managed to produce them at a time in our human evolution where profiting with massive profit margins for these drugs is now expected. And that is putting these fundamental tools in our toolbox outside the reach of many of the people.
It's obscene.
Correct.
Well, on the list of things that give most people in healthcare joy in practice, training the next generation is often high on the list. The ability to welcome new people into the professions, all of them, to influence them and to try and impart the best that we have to share. What are you seeing in the generation of students of the health professions that are coming into the Mayo or other institutions you work with? They're looking at a generation before them that, as you say, may be experiencing burnout at unprecedented levels. What are you doing to help them get on a track that allows them to really keep that joy and commitment that they came into it with?
Well, I'm waiting for the easy questions, but this is a very
we don't have any.
This is a very interesting challenge because some people are going into healthcare having bought the notion that healthcare is an industry that represents, you know, I don't know, 20% of our economy, the biggest employer in most states in the United States, and therefore a business opportunity beyond the usual, you know, making a living aspect of healthcare that perhaps brings in nurses and doctors and other folks in direct patient care. And many people are actually going, for instance, to medical school, not to take care of patients, but actually to join the ranks of biotech executives and other folks in that realm. I think that's okay, I presume, but seems to me like a missed opportunity. At the same time, I think there is a swell of a new wave of young people who are looking to dedicate their lives to something bigger than themselves. Social media has given them a world that is very small, that is very superficial, that offers cheapens existence, and they're looking for something more meaningful in their lives. And there's nothing more meaningful than dedicating your life to the care of other people. Mm-hmm. And so it's very important that those who have a voice in healthcare, whether they are healthcare executives or healthcare professional leaders, anybody that has the chance of using their voice. They need to remind themselves and others that the fundamental reason we have these organizations and these careers and these opportunities is because we're here to care for people. And the moment we betray that is the moment we once again give up on the potential, enormous potential that young people have to bring about a better world. In this case, a world in which the main thing we do between humans is to care for and about each other.
Well, that's a great note to end on. Dr. Montori, thank you for joining us today. Thanks to our audience for being here. Just a reminder to be sure to subscribe to our videos on YouTube and find us on Facebook and X. And you can also share your thoughts and comments on the program. Take care and be well.
This copyrighted program is produced by Conversations on Healthcare and cannot be reproduced or retransmitted in whole or in part without the express written consent from Community Health Center, Inc. The views expressed by guests are their own, and they do not necessarily reflect the opinion of Conversations on Healthcare or its affiliated entities.